You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including ongoing turmoil at a fire district in the Rogue Valley, the rebranding of a lavender store in Ashland, and a lawsuit against the city of Medford. I'm Eric Newman, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm James Kelly, JPR's news intern for the summer.
Jane, we're going to start with you. You've been following the ongoing troubles at Jackson County Fire District 5. Tell us about the report you covered this week and what new information it contains.
So basically, I got more information this week, more details about the firing of the former fire chief, Charles Hanley. So he was fired by the district's board of directors about 2 weeks ago. And the reason was that there were three allegations against him that were found to be sustained by an independent investigator. And so those three allegations were covering up sexual harassment, bullying, and interfering with a governmental promotion board. And then I just recently got a copy of that investigator's report through a public records request, and so now had some more details about that. And so the first allegation was that Hanley failed to address workplace harassment. The report says that Hanley himself said sexual harassment in the district was rampant, but the report also found that Hanley stopped an investigation into misconduct. There was also an allegation of bullying, and so the report found that Hanley had harassed an employee earlier this year by using curse words and yelling aggressively. The report says his actions were intimidating and offensive and created a hostile environment. And then the report also says on that third allegation that Hanley had altered promotional scores for an employee who was trying to become battalion chief, which unfairly disqualified a candidate. And I should say I reached out to Hanley himself, and he sent a statement through his attorney saying that he was disappointed by the board's decision, he disagrees with the investigation's findings, and he's going to contest his termination.
Okay, so give us some background on what's been happening in the district recently.
Right, there's been a lot going on. So the district operates three fire stations in Phoenix, Talent, and unincorporated Ashland. It serves just over 23,000 people. In February, the union had asked the board of directors to take action to address some complaints about inappropriate conduct in the department. And then in March, three out of the five board members suddenly resigned. The county board of commissioners had to appoint new board members. And then they fired the chief, as I just said. And then they're also dealing with some financial issues. They're facing a potential shortfall of up to $3 million. The district could run out of money by November. Wow. There's been some apparent overspending, so they're working to address that as well.
So that's a lot of things to keep track of, but also the district recently received a letter threatening a lawsuit?
Yes. So the former board chair, Vicki Perslow, she's one of the ones who resigned suddenly that I just mentioned. Her attorney sent a letter to the district threatening a lawsuit on August 12th. It's addressed to the district, the board chair, the union president, and one of the board members. And that letter says that Vicki Perslow has been slandered and defamed. It's seeking at least $2 million in damages. She says that her civil rights have been violated. She was the only woman on the board, and she's also a lesbian. And she calls out one board member in particular, Derek Volkart, because he had requested an investigation into Perslow. Her letter says there's a lack of evidence, and it was all just trying to attack her, basically. So that's the letter that her attorney sent, and then the district itself has not responded, but the union's attorney has. And that response is asking for specific examples that they have, statements that the clients have made about Perslow. They want some specific statements that have been made. That letter says there's a high bar to constitute defamation and slander under the law, and claims that the union has not done that. And the letter also mentions that Oregon has anti-slap statutes, which protects defendants from being sued for exercising their free speech rights. So the letter's kind of pushing back on that as well. So we'll have to see what happens next.
Okay, so that's a lot to keep track of. Jane has reported many stories on this topic that can be found on ijpr.org. James, we're going to turn to you now. You've been looking into why a lavender store in Ashland recently rebranded. It's a story that's a little more complicated than it seems on the surface. Tell us more.
Yep. So the store is here in Ashland, and it's called True Lavender Collective. And it used to be Pelindaba Lavender. Basically, it was a franchise of the Pelindaba Lavender Farm in Washington. And that means the store here in Ashland was independently owned, but had a very specific contract with the farm about what it could sell, how it could operate. And I find out that the store basically had to be rebranded in January of this year after the farm in Washington very strangely shut down. So I began talking to the owner of the Ashland store. Her name is Julie Harden, and she told me that the farm basically disappeared off the face of the earth. Those are her words, and she doesn't mean literally, but in early January, the farm closed without any notice. Harden says the owner of the farm didn't communicate with her at all about the farm closing, which was strange to her because up until that point, the farm had been very communicative about expectations, keeping up its contract, and she was really caught off guard by this. And to make matters worse, she said the farm had not delivered thousands of dollars of prepaid shipments to her store. She says she's owed about 13 grand. And it's probably important to say at this point, too, that she was just one of seven formerly Pelindaba Lavender franchises across the country. There were stores in Oregon, Washington, Texas, Georgia, and Florida. And all the store owners were also not getting shipments from the farm. And then it closed down in January. So they all sort of had to figure out if they had the resources to rebrand. And that's what Harden did here in Ashland.
So what happened to this farm in the San Juan Islands?
Right. So when I first talked to Harden, it seemed to her like it was kind of a mystery. The farm had been in business for 25 years, and basically one day it just disappeared. And from Harden's perspective, that's like pretty much accurate, although she was able to pass along some very important email chains and court documents, so she was really helpful. And she did have some grasp, but from her perspective, it did look like it kind of just disappeared. So I did some digging and looked into court documents from the San Juan County Superior Court, which is the county the farm is located in. And realized basically that the owner of the farm is a man named Don Steven Robbins, was millions of dollars in debt to the bank, and that's what the bank's complaint says. And since 2012, he'd been taking out millions of dollars in loans on the farmland and basically just never paid the bank back. So in May of last year, after all the loans were basically supposed to be paid back in full, you know, their maturity dates, the bank complained because they weren't paid back in full. And so the bank tried to move forward with foreclosing on his properties. So unfortunately, I talked to Harden, who remember owned the Ashland franchise. I talked to her and one other owner, and neither of them said they were aware of the farm's financial situation at all. The owner was not upfront with them about any of that. They knew that Robbins was planning to sell the farmland with some special stipulations that would basically allow the Lavender Farm to continue running. But they didn't know much more than that, and they didn't really know why he was going to try to do that. So come to find out, basically, the bank is now in the process of trying to get its money back. And that might look like a foreclosure, but a summary judgment hearing right now is set for September 17th. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Wow. So what did this rebranding process look like for this store in Ashland?
Well, she said it was really hard. She said that the $13,000 she is owed still was pretty much what it would have costed to rebrand. But the good news is she was able to hang on because she had just enough inventory to get her through some difficult months. She's basically been getting her business back on its feet after having the rug pulled out from under her. And now she's finding local women-owned lavender farms and sourcing from them now. She says she went from one supplier to over 60, and including making her own products. So she says she's enjoying a bit more freedom in choosing the product she can sell. Before, when she was a franchise owner, the contract with the farm was so strict that she could only sell Pelindaba products pretty much. So she's enjoying more of that freedom now, and she says the business is doing really well.
Cool. Well, thanks for unraveling the mystery of the Lavender store in Ashland. We're going to turn to Justin next. Justin, who is joining us remotely, you reported this week on a lawsuit from the ACLU against the city of Medford. What was this lawsuit about?
Yeah, so the ACLU of Oregon is alleging that Medford police illegally surveilled local activists and organizers. Those named in the suit who claim they were targeted by the Medford police are Rogue Valley Pepper Shakers. They're a kind of mutual aid organization that does work with marginalized communities in the Rogue Valley. Also, Stab and Wagon, that's a mobile harm reduction group that we've covered before, and Melissa Jones, former director of Stab and Wagon, is also named in the suit. And the lawsuit claims that police broke state law by monitoring these groups' social media accounts when no crime was suspected. So these groups weren't suspected of committing any crimes, but police were still looking into them. And this monitoring was revealed through a public records request by a transparency group called Information for Public Use. Those public records show communication between officers and detectives in the Medford Police Department about monitoring events like a drive-in movie celebrating Juneteenth, planned protests against the Supreme Court when they overturned Roe v. Wade, And those events, to know, those events were all peaceful.
And so what is the ACLU arguing that the Medford Police Department, what is the law that the ACLU is arguing that MPD violated?
It's a 1981 law that bans law enforcement from collecting political or religious or social information about individuals or groups unless it's directly related to a crime. And that law was actually created because Portland police in the 70s were monitoring the ACLU of Oregon, as well as other activists, and they had collected these dossiers on activists who had committed no crime. The ACLU is saying that the Medford police are basically doing the same thing, just in an online way. They're keeping digital dossiers on activists when no crime is suspected.
So what did the Medford Police Department say about these allegations?
So I got a statement from the Medford city attorney, and he denied that Medford police broke state law. And his reasoning is because he says that the police purpose in surveilling these social media accounts wasn't to collect information on individuals or groups' political views. Instead, officers were monitoring their online activity for potential public safety concerns, like traffic disruptions or potential property damage that could occur after rallies or protests. And use an example from 2020 when the city had to reroute traffic and try to mitigate some conflicts, potential conflicts between protesters and counter-protesters for, he used that as an example for a goal in monitoring these social media accounts.
Hmm. So what happens next with this lawsuit?
We'll see what a judge says, but it is an interesting case. Kind of when I was reporting it, I saw both sides as pretty compelling. The police in Oregon have shown in the past that they can't really be trusted in collecting information on citizens unless they're investigating a crime. And this monitoring can also have a chilling effect on organizing. If people are worried that authorities are monitoring them, they might be less likely to put on events or rallies. But also, while the protests in the Rogue Valley were peaceful around 2020, and even the Medford police chief at that time said that the protests were overwhelmingly peaceful, in other parts of the country and state, there were cases of looting and arson and property damage and stuff. So I guess the question is whether police should be able to look at publicly available information for a heads up on protests or rallies that have even a really small chance of getting out of control.
Hmm. Well, thanks a lot, Justin. We'll continue to follow this. Roman, we're going to turn to you now. So you reported on a public meeting this week of the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors. So they were concerned about a program to bus homeless people from San Francisco to Humboldt County. What was this all about?
Yeah, this is a program called Journey Home that was started in September of last year by San Francisco. It pays for transportation for people who are homeless or have substance use disorder to somewhere where either they've lived before or they have friends or family at. So supervisors in Humboldt County recently found out that their county is one of the top three destinations in California for people through this program. And so they're worried that because of the relaxed requirements of this program, that people are getting sent here without assurances that they'll have the housing or the support that they need. They already, people in Humboldt County already struggle to provide housing for their own homeless population. So they're worried about taking on more of a burden.
Okay. And so do you know if these allegations and concerns are true? And if so, how many homeless people came from San Francisco to Humboldt County?
Yeah. Initially, when we reported on the story, we didn't necessarily confirm the facts because supervisors were discussing all this based on a news article from the San Francisco Standard, which reported that Humboldt's one of the top three counties. But I did hear back from the San Francisco Human Services Agency yesterday, and they did say that from September of 2023 to today, around 90 people have relocated through this program. 29 of those have been sent to somewhere else in California. And then Humboldt's actually tied for second place in terms of the top counties. Sacramento received 6 people, and then LA and Humboldt counties each received 5 people each over that entire year span. So to put that in perspective, county staff presented their latest point in time count. There are 1,573 homeless individuals in the county, so an extra 5 people isn't a lot.
Right.
But supervisors are going to get their staff to work with county staff in San Francisco and kind of figure out what they can do to solve those issues. And maybe they might send a letter to the county, the San Francisco mayor as well.
Okay, great. Well, we will continue to follow that story as well. Thanks, Roman. That is going to do it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments about our coverage and suggestions for things that we should cover in the future through our news tip line, which is on our website at ijpr.org. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.